Hello again. Ecclesiastes, eh? It's a tough book. It's kind of weird. It's got a lot of isolated sayings. And there's not much context there to figure out what those sayings mean. And the order of the sayings, sometimes it's hard to figure out. Why have you put that one behind after that one? And there's different ways to understand the book as a whole. So before I start on chapter 7, I want to explain how I understand Ecclesiastes as a whole. So I see Ecclesiastes as the sincere perspective of a man who's only partially informed about God and his plans. Now, the idea of a Bible writer being only partially informed shouldn't surprise us. Not even Jesus himself had all the details. Not even the Son knows the day or the hour. So the Bible writers who lived thousands of years before Jesus, they didn't know everything. The Bible was written over thousands of years, and when Ecclesiastes was written, there's still a lot that had not yet been revealed. God revealed his salvation plan gradually, over time, carefully adding the new elements at the right time until the stage was finally set for Christ. We live in 2024, after the completion of the Bible. The teacher, the guy who wrote most of Ecclesiastes, probably Solomon, didn't have the revelation that we have. He lived early on in biblical history. Now, he did have some revelation. He knew there was a righteous God, and that God would somehow judge our deeds. But he didn't know all the details about how that judgment would work. He didn't yet have clear revelation about a final judgment at the final resurrection. He just knew that somehow God would judge our deeds. Now, the teacher mentions God's judgment a number of times throughout the book. And at the end of the book, in chapter 12, the second author, the narrator, mentions the judgment too. So both the teacher and the narrator agree that somehow God will judge our deeds. But neither suggest anything about a final resurrection or even an afterlife. It's not that they deny an afterlife. It's just that they didn't know what would happen after death. Who knows if the spirit of a man goes upward and if the spirit of the animal goes down to earth? Now, I'm no expert on this, but as far as I can tell, they didn't know what would happen after death. Only later, when prophets like Isaiah and Daniel came along, were we given clearer revelations about the final resurrection and judgment. The teacher's conclusion was the best that he could come up with, given the revelation that he had. But it's not the best that we can come up with, given the revelation that we have. Death no longer has the final say. Death has been swallowed up in victory. You know that your labour in the Lord is not in vain. It's not meaningless. We've learned a bit since the teacher's time. So what's the point of even reading a book like Ecclesiastes? One reason is that it does contain wise advice, advice that is still relevant today on this side of the cross. A second reason is it's a reminder to be grateful for the revelation, the hope we have. Ecclesiastes reminds us of how hopeless life would feel without knowledge of the resurrection. Understanding the darkness that he felt then should make us appreciate the light that we have now. So that's how I'm going to interpret Ecclesiastes and chapter 7. Chapter 7 is about wisdom. Many Bibles have the subtitle, Wisdom. The teacher wants to investigate how to get wisdom so that he can tell the people how to get wisdom. He especially wants to uncover the ultimate wisdom behind creation, the scheme of everything. But the teacher fails to find this scheme. He failed to uncover the point of creation. So for the teacher, everything under the sun just seems like mist or breath. Here 1 minute, gone the next. So there's a sadness and a frustration mixed in with the teacher's search for wisdom. But he did his best to seek wisdom anyway. And he did discover some useful insights about people, including our human helplessness and corruption. The teacher didn't know it at the time, but this realization, this acceptance of our own helplessness and corruption, was the first step in God's plan to save us from it. God had to humble us before he could glorify us. But for now, let's focus on chapter 7. So chapter 7, I've divided up into 7 sections. In 1, we're encouraged to mourn and accept our mortality. Part 2, there's some short tips on getting wiser. Part 3, we're encouraged to recognise only God is in control. Part 4, don't judge. Part 5, the teacher failed to find wisdom, but he kept searching. Part 6, certain kinds of women can be a snare. And part 7, the minds of most people seem too filled with their own schemes to leave room for God's. Now, much of what the teacher is saying is about his failure to find wisdom. So as if to balance this out, we've got interspersed among all this 3 comments on the benefits of wisdom. Wisdom preserves life, wisdom strengthens, and wisdom encourages. By the end of the chapter, we're left with a message that although the teacher has failed to find wisdom, he nevertheless believes we should value and seek wisdom nonetheless. Now, that might not be that encouraging if the story ended at that. But on this side of the cross, we know that wisdom has been found, or rather, revealed. So let's start. We'll start with part 1. Mourn. A good name is better than perfume, and the day of death better than the day of one's birth. Just as having a good name is better than having a nice smell, so death is better than birth. What? That's kind of shocking, confronting. Now, just to be clear, this is not a call to seek death. God put us here for a purpose. And some might think of this as kind of a poetic expression of the despair that the teacher felt. But more likely, he's trying to help us become wiser by considering our own death, our own mortality, our own finiteness. And he wants us to take that to heart. Verse 2. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for death is the end of all men, and the living should take this to heart. We should take to heart the fact that our days are numbered. It's better to face up to the sad realities of this life than try to constantly distract ourselves with foolish pleasures, houses of feasting. Sad reality can actually be good for the heart. Sorrow is better than laughter because a sad face is good for the heart. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. How does that sadness and that humbling produce a wise heart? Well, maybe because it faces up to the reality of our own corruption. Remember, death is there to humble us. Just imagine a world where human beings never died. We just continued on with our stupid stuff, made more atomic weapons, etc. God had to humble us before he could glorify us. This acceptance of our death can bring a kind of peace, but also for us on this side of the cross, when we dare to face the true sorrow of the human problem, or the more we face that, the more we appreciate the joy and the comfort of God's solution. As Jesus said, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." Now, the teacher was uninformed about Jesus, but we're not. Now, we can still grieve our losses, and that can be really important, but we don't have to grieve without hope. As the Apostle Paul said, "We do not want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who have died, so that you may not grieve as others do who have no hope." So we should face up to the reality of death, let that reality humble us, and mourn for the tragic situation that humanity is in, but balance that out with the hope that we have in Jesus to save humanity. So that's part one. Now to part two, some tips on how to get wiser. It is better to heed a wise man's rebuke than to listen to the song of fools. A fool will sing you the pretty song you want to hear, rather than give you the rebuke you need to survive. We don't have to heed every criticism, but if someone wise rebukes you, heed the rebuke. Next tip, about unwholesome laughter. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. You know, it's not all laughter, it's talking about foolish laughter. This too is breath. So imagine you're camping and you build a fire to cook your dinner and you put a pot of stew over the fire, and then to make that fire, you put thorns on the fire. Now when you light the thorns, they'll flare up bright and hot for a moment, but then they'll quickly die down and your dinner will be cold and you'll go hungry. In the same way, the laughter of fools, it feels good for a moment, but then it quickly passes and it leaves nothing of satisfaction. Like breath or mist, the satisfaction will quickly vanish. So let's stick to wholesome laughter. Next tip, extortion turns a wise man into a fool and a bribe corrupts the heart. Even a wise person can be turned into a fool if they start accepting bribes. A bribe can be the thin edge of the wedge that splits apart a good character. Next tip, the end of the matter is better than the beginning, and patience is better than pride. Do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools. Fools are quickly angered. It's not hard to hurt their pride, but the wise will value patience. Last tip, do not say, "Why were the old days better than these?" For it is not wise to ask such questions. It's not wise to be always pining for the good old times. Instead, we should face the situation in front of us. So that's a few quick tips to make us a bit wiser. This kind of wisdom will preserve our lives. Wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing and benefits those who see the sun. Wisdom is a shelter, as money is a shelter. But the advantage of knowledge is this, that wisdom preserves the life of its possessor. The teacher knew that wisdom could preserve earthly life. How much more should we value wisdom now that we know about the life to come? Okay, the next section is on control. Only God is in control. The wise person will recognize they can't control the future or even predict the future. God will straighten whatever he wants to straighten, and he'll make crooked whatever he wants to make crooked. The bad and crooked times should remind us that only God knows our future. Who can straighten what God has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider. God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, a man cannot discover anything about his future. It is God who brings good times and God who brings bad times. If God wants to make tomorrow crooked and painful, we can't stop him. We can't even predict when it'll happen. Only God is in control. But some might assume that they can control their lifespan by righteous living. They think that if they lead an extra righteous life, they'll be rewarded with good times and avoid the crooked times. But not even the righteous are guaranteed a long and happy life. In this passing life of mine, I have seen both of these: a righteous man perishing in his righteousness, and a wicked man living long in his wickedness. The teacher was honest enough to call it as he saw it. He saw with his eyes that sometimes the righteous perish and the wicked thrive. even though he believed by faith that God will judge our deeds. He didn't know how those two things could be reconciled with the amount of revelation that he had, so he just stated them both. We now know that God will balance the scales of justice at the final resurrection. But he didn't know that. Do not be over-righteous, neither be over-wise. Why destroy yourself? Do not be over-wicked, neither, and do not be a fool. Why die before your time? It is good to grasp the one and not let go of the other. The man who fears God will avoid both extremes. Now, the man who fears God will avoid both extremes. Now, we would expect that a man who fears God will avoid being over wicked, because he knows if he gets too wicked, God might kill him before his time. But why would a man who fears God avoid being over righteous? Now, it's possible that he's saying that trying too hard to be righteous is just wasted effort. After all, God might have an early death plan for you anyway. But there are other possibilities. A second possibility, this is about knowing your limits as a fragile and finite human being. Allocating time to recover and smell the roses so you don't burn yourself out and end up a burden to others. And a third possibility, did I mention Ecclesiastes? It's hard to interpret. Is that the terms over-righteous and over-wise are referring not to the amount of effort, but to the type of effort. Try hard to obey God's command. That's the right type of effort. But don't start adding your own commands. That's the wrong type of effort. Don't inflict requirements on yourself that not even God asked for. Throughout history, people with an unhealthy terror of God, so they were viewing God as if there's a bully in the sky, for example, and also men with overinflated ideas of their own wisdom, have added their own human regulations to God's laws. And some end up just burning themselves out with all this unnecessary effort. Others trap themselves in vows they didn't need to make. And the worst of all, inflict their regulations on others and become really judgmental. Remember the Pharisees. So if that's what overwise mean, it's referring to a sort of arrogance, which makes overwise sound a bit bad. So to balance this out, the teacher wants to remind us that there are upsides to wisdom. Whoops. Wisdom makes one wise man more powerful than 10 rulers in a city. One wise man. Now the word man here is basically just means mankind, so who's men and women. So it could also mean a woman like Abigail. In 1 Samuel 25, one wise woman, Abigail, saves many people from the wrath of an army. Her husband, Nabal, a surly and mean man, had become rude and stingy towards an army that had been quite good to him. And he'd end up putting his whole household in danger. That household was quite a big, it says household, but there'd be hundreds, maybe thousands of people. But Abigail, through her wisdom, managed to calm the situation and save everyone. One wise woman was more powerful than 10 rulers. Next section, don't judge. There's not a righteous man on earth who does what is right and never sins. Do not pay attention to every word people say, or you may hear your servant cursing you. For you know in your heart that many times you yourself have cursed others. We've all said bad things about others from time to time, so we shouldn't pay too much attention when others say bad things about us. Maybe they were just having a bad day. Maybe we deserved it. The wise person would be prepared to let a few comments slide. Next part, searching. This section is about Solomon's search for wisdom and how he failed to find it. All this, by which he means all these tips we've just been talking about, I tested by wisdom and I said, I'm determined to be wise, but this was beyond me. In other words, he's confident that the tips he's just given us are wise, but that doesn't mean he is wise. There's just so much that's beyond him. Whatever wisdom may be, it's far off and most profound. Who can discover it? Ultimate wisdom feels so far beyond his reach, he feels he doesn't even know what it is. But he kept turning his mind to it anyway, kept searching for it anyway. Verse 25. I turned my mind, and I think the sense there is kept turning my mind to understand, to investigate and search out wisdom and the scheme of things, and to understand the stupidity of wickedness and the madness of folly. So he paints himself as a guy who keeps searching for wisdom and knows enough to give us a few tips, but nevertheless has so much more to learn. Part 6, the snare. Now the teacher warns against not all women, but a certain kind of woman, women who use entrapment. Now by entrapment, I mean tricking people into doing foolish things that they otherwise wouldn't do. I find more bitter than death the woman who is a snare, whose heart is a trap and whose hands are chains. The man who pleases God will escape her, but the sinner she will ensnare. Now the Bible does warn about men who are snares for women. We've just heard about Nabal, the foolish husband of Abigail. And in Malachi 2:16, we hear about men who clothe themselves with violence, men who use violence in the context of marriage. Now, just because the Bible mentions men who use violence doesn't mean it's saying that all men use violence or that only men, it's only the men who are using violence. And in the same way, this is not saying that all women use entrapment or that it's only women who are using entrapment. This is the experience of the teacher himself, a personal experience. It starts with the words, I find. So it shouldn't be taken as an attack on all women or used as an attack on all women. So what does it mean? Is this Solomon talking about his many wives? Solomon had practiced polygamy, and worse than that, he started marrying women who worship false gods. This is a sin. This could be Solomon saying he was the one who failed to please God. He became the sinner, and therefore he was ensnared. Now, polygamy, although not explicitly condemned, as far as I know, in the Old Testament, it's never been God's ideal. I mean, you don't see polygamy in the Garden of Eden, right? It's Adam and Eve, not Adam and his thousand wives. So this could be just Solomon talking about his own experience. But it is also a warning for the rest of us that if we sin and we get entangled with the kinds of women that God forbids, prostitutes, promiscuous women, we're more likely to become ensnared too. Part 7, scheming minds. Look, says the teacher, this is what I've discovered, adding one thing to another to discover the scheme of things. While I was searching, but not finding, I found one man among a thousand, but not one woman among them all. This only have I found. God made man upright, but men have gone in search of many schemes. The teacher was looking for people to help him discover God's schemes of things, but he found very few that had insight. Instead, most were fixated on their own schemes. The ability to scheme and calculate and strategize are not bad things in themselves. It depends on why we scheme. We sometimes get rusted on to our own schemes, our own agendas, our own biases. They cloud our judgment, and they can become our idols. Political schemes, financial schemes, family schemes, our schemes choke out God's schemes and we become fools. Now there's sort of a weird comment there in verse 28. Where he says, one man among a thousand, but not one woman among them all. I know that in the NIV it talks as one upright man, and they've inserted the word upright, but that's not in the original Hebrew. Now, a simple look at Solomon's own family tree will reveal women of intelligence and good character. Abigail is described as a woman of intelligence and Ruth as a woman of noble character. So why does the teacher make a distinction between men and women? Now, we have to be careful here not to read into this verse more than is actually there. Just because the teacher couldn't find any women who he thought were wise or helpful enough doesn't mean there aren't any. We've already heard about Ruth and Abigail. We could talk about Esther, Deborah, Miriam, and so on. So we don't know whether the difference that the teacher observes is because of something cultural that's specific to his context. And one of the suggestions the commentators put forward is education. Back then, women just didn't have access to education. It could be something that is to do specific or intrinsic to women, or it could be a combination of both. We just don't know. And there are so few men who passed his standards, and there's only 1 in 1,000 who got through, that some commentators suggest there's really no difference at all. And this is really just a Hebrew figure of speech. It's not intending to make a distinction. At the end of the day, we just don't know. All we can do is speculate. The main point that the teacher's trying to make is that nearly all people had lost sight of God's schemes, probably because they were too busy chasing their own. Wisdom escapes him, and he's left feeling sad and frustrated. And we're left feeling a bit sad and frustrated after listening to him. But there is hope. The teacher wants to balance things out by saying that if wisdom can be found, it'll encourage us and brighten our faces. Oops. Who is like the wise man? Who knows the explanation of things? Wisdom brightens a man's face and changes its hard expression. So, can we find this wisdom? Can we find this elusive thing? Where would we go to find it? The modern scholar looks for a watertight argument to get wisdom, but God's given us something much more impressive than that. He's given us a watertight person, Jesus himself. Christ himself was the ultimate revelation of God's wisdom. As the Apostle Paul said, "We speak of God's secret wisdom, Christ himself, a wisdom that has been kept hidden and that God destined for our glory before time began." Christ was God's secret wisdom, kept hidden during the teacher's time. The teacher described many hard aspects of life, the things that God has given to humble us in this earthly life, but only for a time. All along, God has been planning to resurrect and glorify us. And even before he glorifies us in the next life, he's already started blessing us in this one. The wisdom of God is already blessing us, even here on earth. Through the gospel, we've seen a restoration of the dignity of women. It's not an accident that it was women who were pouring into the early church. Same thing applies for slaves. We've seen a return to monogamy. We've seen a valuing of charity, so that charity started developing where Christianity was founded. Hospitals, schools, universities. All these are connected to the Judeo-Christian tradition. The wisdom of God has been slowly but surely changing our world and brightening the faces of many. So just as I finish to pray, I'll invite the musicians up. Dear Father, thank you. For a time, you had to humble us, and we read the teacher's painful experience of that. But thank you that there was always more to the story. Thank you for your gift of wisdom, especially through Jesus. Amen.